Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the LSE. My name is Michael Leifer. I'm the director of the Asia Research Center at the school, under whose aegis this lecture on the Chinese Revolution is being delivered. It was once said of the late Zhou Enlai that he was asked for his opinion as to the significance of the French Revolution. And he said it's too early to tell. Well, there are no such inhibitions at the LSE, and certainly none on the part of our distinguished lecturer this evening, Maurice Meisner. Maurice Meisner is Harvey Gorberg Professor of History at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and is also currently visiting Centennial Professor at the school, attached both to the Department of International History and also to the Asia Research Center. He's a distinguished and a prolific historian of modern China. He's written about the intellectual history of the Chinese Revolution and also about its more conventional history, most recently in a book entitled Mao's China and After, A History of the People's Republic. It's gone into its third edition, and his works have been translated into seven languages. It's almost 50 years since the Central People's Government of the People's Republic of China was established, and it's from that perspective that Professor Meisner is going to address the subject of the significance of the Chinese Revolution in world history. Professor Meisner.
I'd like to thank Professor Leifer for that very generous introduction and also express my gratitude to him for the opportunity to be at the Asian Research Center, which has offered marvelous hospitality and an intellectually stimulating environment, and I am extraordinarily grateful to him and his kindness and for that opportunity. This is perhaps not a terribly auspicious time to undertake a fair and serious assessment of the Chinese Communist Revolution. There is a great deal of anti-Chinese feeling abroad in the world today, as I think you know, especially in the United States, where it appears we are witnessing yet another episode of the Who Lost China witch hunt. One is tempted to say, as Professor Leifer himself quoted in an excellent lecture last week, tempted to say, along with Hegel and Marx, that historic events occurred twice, the first time as tragedy, the second as farce, with regard to the apparently resumed Who Lost China debate in the United States. But this is a farce with potentially deadly implications, I am unhappy to conclude. Along with that farce, there is increased questioning, and has been for some years now, of the legitimacy of the Long Revolution, as it's sometimes called, that produced the People's Republic of China in 1949, questioning now a half century after the event. For example, one reads in a recent issue of the International Herald Tribune that all of China's failures, or perceived failures, are, quote, sustained by a mistaken belief in the correctness of the 1949 revolution. The writer, a well-regarded and respected scholar, goes on to say that progress in China depends, or at least progress in the direction which the writer regards as the right direction, depends on the Chinese leadership recognizing that the revolution was a failure and renouncing it. I am not among those who believe that the Chinese Revolution was a failure. And I'll try to suggest why this evening, why I don't share that belief. Indeed, I believe that there are few events in world history which have done more to better the lives of more people than the Maoist victory of 1949 and the socioeconomic transformations that followed from that victory. And I say that with an acute and painful awareness of all the horrors and crimes that accompanied the revolution, followed from it, and sometimes were done in the name of the revolution. The labor camps, the almost continuous political and ideological witch hunts, the denial of free expression and basic rights of association, and the terrible famine that followed from the political misadventure of the Great Leap, a famine caused less by a lack of food than by the rather malignant workings of a Stalinist political system. Despite all of this, I believe the revolution was not only important, but beneficial. And let me try to tell you why. The revolution itself, as it unfolded primarily in the rural areas of China in the 1930s and 1940s, was certainly the most massive and most popular revolution in world history. Massive in terms of the numbers of the people who were directly involved in the revolutionary movement, and the even greater numbers of people who were whose lives were crucially changed by the outcome of that revolution. Popular in terms of the proportion of the population actively involved in the revolutionary effort. It was also perhaps in many ways the most heroic of revolutions, a heroism symbolized by the legendary Long March of the mid-1930s, but a heroism by no means confined to that odyssey, a heroism displayed by quite literally tens of millions of people that made for the revolution's success. The Chinese Communist Revolution was not a revolutionary coup d'etat. It was a popular revolution in the sense of the number of people who participated in it and I think who benefited from it. It's not my purpose this evening to celebrate the 1949 revolution, which Professor Liefer has noted, is now celebrates its 50th anniversary this week, or this year rather, but rather simply to share with you some thoughts about the long-term historical significance of that revolution. And I stress long-term because great social revolutions often do not reveal their true historical meanings until many decades after the event. For example, it took nearly a century after the French Revolution of 1789, and I think it is possible still to say something today, to say something about the French Revolution of 1789. It's perhaps too early to say too much about the Chinese Revolution, but one can say something about the French Revolution. It took nearly a century after 1789 to know that the French Revolution had given a powerful impetus to capitalist development, and had yielded a political democracy. For almost 100 years after 1789, the democratic ideals of the French Revolution were perverted by various kinds of despotism, Napoleonic despotism, the restoration of the Bourbons, the dictatorship of Louis Bonaparte, and so forth. And it was not really until the establishment of the Third Republic in 1871 that a democratic political system took root in France, based, it was said, on a resurrection of the partly forgotten ideals of the of 1789. It may take then a century or more to fully understand the social outcome of a revolution. Furthermore, revolutions, it seems to me, must be studied in functional terms. That is to say, in terms of what they actually do historically and socially, rather than what the revolutionaries intended the revolution to do. It is, of course, important to know what happened in the revolutions, what the motivations of the revolutionaries were, their social composition, and so forth. But it's more important, I think, to know what issues from a revolution in the long term, and that long term, as I suggested, may be many decades, it may be, in fact, a century or more. In the case of the Chinese Revolution, for example, it's obviously important to know that the revolution was largely made by peasants. It's no less, however, important to know that the revolution made by peasants inaugurated a process of development that is reducing the peasantry to an ever smaller minority of the Chinese population. In many senses, which I won't go into now, peasants were both the beneficiaries and the victims of the revolution they made. Let me, before saying anything more about that, which I probably won't have time to do in any event, let me explain why I have been rethinking the significance of the Chinese Revolution in recent months and over the past year. Several years ago, precisely in the autumn of 1996, I published a book on the history of contemporary China under the title The Deng Xiaoping Era, An Inquiry into the Fate of Chinese Socialism. One chapter in that book was entitled Bureaucratic Capitalism, which I argued was the main social result of the post-Maoist market reform policies, in effect a sort of marriage between the market and a Stalinist political system. With that chapter and conclusion in mind, Professor Bruce Cummings of the University of Chicago, who reviewed the book, made the following observation. It is now an entirely fair question to ask if the Chinese communists have created anything enduring that would not also have been accomplished under the nationalists, that is to say, under the Kuomintang, the losing party in China's massive and bitter civil war, which has now resided on the island of Taiwan for more than 50 years. Professor Cummings, one of the world's most eminent political economists, poses here a question that echoes a very common critique of revolution in general, and certainly, as far as I'm concerned, the most compelling critique of revolution. And that is the argument that post-revolutionary regimes, at best, merely continue the basic socio-economic tendencies that were at work under the old regimes that they replaced. It's an argument that is often made with regard to the French Revolution. In the case of France, it's argued that the processes of bureaucratic centralization, of modern state building, the development of capitalist forces of production, all of which followed from the revolution of 1789, were in fact processes that were well underway under the old monarchy, and that these processes would have triumphed had the 1789 revolution never occurred. In short, the revolution was unnecessary, and all the human and material costs of the revolutionary upheaval are therefore morally and historically indefensible. There are, of course, other kinds of arguments against revolution in general, which I won't burden you with, having to do with tradition, the reconciling of means and ends, and so forth. But it seems to me that the argument that revolutions are unnecessary in the sense that I mentioned before, because they merely continue at very high cost, basic processes of historical development already taking place, is the argument that should be taken the most seriously. And it is the one, I think, that is implied in Professor Cumming's query as to whether the Chinese Communist regime accomplished anything worthwhile that would not have been accomplished had the nationalists or the Kuomintang remained in power after 1949. The question that Professor Cumming raised in that review, which appeared some time after the publication of the book, remained with me long after I read his review, and it made me think once again about the nature and significance of the Chinese Communist Revolution, what it accomplished, what it failed to accomplish, and whether it was justified. And what I would like to do in the time that remains is to briefly share those thoughts with you and hopefully allow enough time to invite your critical comments and responses. In considering the successes and the failures of the 1949 revolution, my thoughts first go back to a crucial chapter in modern Chinese history that takes place a quarter of a century earlier, to the great revolutionary upsurge that swept China in the mid-1920s. At that time, an extraordinarily militant popular movement of workers and peasants developed in China, proceeding under the political auspices of a rather unusual kind of alliance, an alliance between the Nationalist Party, the Kuomintang of Sun Yat-sen, the Soviet Union working through the Comintern, and the Chinese Communist Party, which had recently been formed. With the Chinese Communist Party, the very much the junior partner in that three-way alliance. The alliance aimed to achieve two main goals. They were nationalist goals. One was national unity, that is to say, the elimination of warlordism in China and separatism, the establishment of a strong central government. Secondly, the alliance aimed to achieve national independence, that is to say, the elimination of the foreign impingements on China that had humbled and humiliated the country over the preceding century. The alliance broke apart after 2 years, in 1927, when the social radicalism of the popular movement, of the mass movement of workers and peasants, went beyond these rather limited nationalist aims of the political alliance. And Chiang Kai-shek, who had succeeded Sun Yat-sen as leader of the Kuomintang, Sun died in 1925, then employed, beginning in April of 1925, employed his Russian-built army to suppress the communists and suppress the popular movement. On the ruins of that movement, in what was a very bloody affair, Chiang Kai-shek established the first national government in China since the revolution of 1911, in many ways since before the revolution of 1911. But it was an ineffective government, as well as a brutal and corrupt one, and proved incapable of realizing the elemental nationalist aims of unity and independence. Warlords still ruled much of the country during the Kuomintang period. Landlords still ruled most of the countryside, and foreigners still held sway in the treaty ports. Yet these essential goals of national unity and independence, which proved so elusive for Chiang Kai-shek, were effectively accomplished within a few months by the communists after their victory of 1949. And these were enormous accomplishments in a country that, for over a century, had suffered so greatly from internal political disintegration and external foreign impingements, and all the human sorrows these entailed. Possibly these nationalist goals would have been achieved in due course by the Kuomintang had it remained in power, but the historical credit quite obviously belongs to the party that actually performed the task, not the one that might have done so had circumstances been different. In a sense, then, one can look upon the revolution of 1949 as a fulfillment of the unrealized aims of the ill-fated Kuomintang Communist Alliance of the mid-1920s, national unification and national independence. To this, the communists can be credited with one other crucial achievement in the early years of the People's Republic, and that is land reform. The land reform campaign of the early 1950s was profoundly important in several respects. First, it destroyed China's gentry landlords as a social class, therefore finally eliminating the longest-lived ruling class in world history. Secondly, land reform brought a measure of social equity to the Chinese countryside, providing at least some land for the poorer sections of the rural population. It also tied even the most remote villages of China to a national political structure through a party network of young peasant activists who lived in the myriad villages of China. Finally, and most importantly, land reform created the essential basis for modern industrial development. By doing away with the parasitic landlord class and by establishing political mechanisms to channel the agrarian surplus to finance state-sponsored industrialization, in human terms, the exploitation of the peasantry. By doing this, the communist revolution opened the way for the industrial revolution that has transformed China from a prominently agrarian country to a prominently industrial one within the space of several decades. What the Chinese communists accomplished during the early years of the People's Republic was essentially a capitalist-type revolution, a bourgeois revolution, albeit without much participation on the part of the Chinese bourgeoisie. They established a centralized state power. They unified the country territorially. They fashioned a disintegrating empire into a modern nation state. They created a national market. And they abolished pre-capitalist relationships in the Chinese countryside. These are the common features of a capitalist or bourgeois revolution. And in China, as elsewhere, they were the preconditions, the essential preconditions for modern economic development. It was on the basis of the political and social achievements of the 1949 revolution, I would argue, that industrialization followed over the next half century. Probably the most impressive process of modernization in world history over a sustained period of time. To appreciate the enormous progress that has been made, one has to take into account the very low starting point from which the process began. In 1952, the year that is usually used to measure economic progress in China, because in 1952, the communists had succeeded in restoring industrial and agricultural production, for that matter, to their highest pre-war levels, that is to say, the highest levels reached before the full-scale Japanese invasion of 1937. In 1952, China's primitive industrial base was even smaller than the industrial plant of Belgium. A country with a population barely 1% of China's population. In short, per capita industrial production, 1/100th approximately of that of Belgium. From that low and miserable and primitive starting point, China has emerged today as probably the world's second largest industrial producer. And depending upon what measurements one employs and what assumptions one makes, China has the world's either second, third, or fourth largest economy as measured in terms of gross domestic product. This transformation, I think, is startling. China, after all, was very long known as the sick man of Asia. It was backward even by Asian standards. But over the past half century has achieved by far the highest rate of growth of any major economy in the world, and this is for a very prolonged period of time. And indeed has achieved the highest rate of industrial growth of any economy in world history at a comparable stage of development. Industrializing, for example, far more rapidly than England did in the first half of the 19th century, that is, the transformation from a primarily industrial or a primarily agrarian to a primarily industrial economy in terms of the total value of production, and far more rapidly than Meiji Japan in the last decades of the 19th and the early decades of the 20th century. It should be emphasized, I think, that the high rates of growth, which has transformed China from a primarily agrarian country into a primarily industrial nation in terms of, the value of production, and probably in terms of employment as well, that is to say, more people are now employed in industrial work in China than are engaged in agricultural production. This did not begin with the market reform era inaugurated by Deng Xiaoping in 1979, as is often assumed. The process began with the long Mao era, the period from 1949 to 1976. about which many Western scholars and commentators have grown silent in conformity with the political orthodoxy of the day. Nevertheless, it was during the Mao period that the essential foundations, however crudely, of China's Industrial Revolution were laid. Without it, the post-Mao reformers would have had very little to reform. Moreover, as the Cambridge economist and Nobel Prize winner Amartya, and I am mispronouncing his first name, I know Professor Liefer pronounced it for me, and Amartya Sen has pointed out that the very extensive development of public education during the Mao period, the development of healthcare, social security of various forms, that these were the essential preconditions, he argues, for economic growth in the post-Mao market reform era. One indication, indication, but certainly a very telling one, but one striking indication of social progress during the Mao period was the dramatic increase in life expectancy, which increased from approximately 35 years prior to 1949 to 65 years in 1976, the year of Mao's death. These achievements in both the Mao and the post-Mao eras would not have been possible, or even conceivable, it seems to me, had it not been for the political and social transformations that followed from the revolution of 1949. Needless to say, I have not mentioned the economic failures, of which there were many, the sluggish growth of agriculture, one might mention both in the Mao, certainly in the Mao period, and to some extent in the post-Mao period as well. Also, the failure in the Mao period to break decisively with the borrowed Soviet model of industrial organization and all the bureaucratic inefficiency and waste that this entailed. But with the exception, and it's a very large exception, of the famine that resulted from the disaster of the Great Leap, the economic record on the whole has been a highly successful one, a uniquely successful one, it seems to me, in many respects, in both the Mao and the post-Mao eras, and especially when one considers the wretchedly low starting point from which China began in the 1940s and 1950s, and the hostile international environment which confronted the People's Republic in its early decades. The great failure of the revolution seems to me to be in the political realm, not the economic one, although the Asian economic crisis may make that statement outmoded before too long. The revolution yielded, as you know, a Stalinist political system, although the more repressive features of that system have been moderated in the post-Mao years, it remains an essentially Stalinist system to this day. Not only did the revolution fail to realize the democratic promises that some held out for it, it also failed to realize its socialist promises. It is not the case that there was a socialist society that somehow was destroyed by Deng Xiaoping's market reforms. There simply was no socialist system in China worthy of the name to destroy. Mao's China was not socialist for a variety of reasons, but principally because it lacked what I consider one of the essential and certainly the most essential feature of socialism, a system whereby the immediate producers have a significant degree of control over the conditions and products of their labor. Quite obviously, that was not the case in the Mao period. And it was well known because a consciousness of the absence of both socialism and democracy was reflected in the slogan that Deng Xiaoping employed to gain support in his drive for power after Mao's death, principally in the year 1978. Socialist democracy was the slogan and the promise of Deng in that year. But quite obviously, neither socialism nor democracy has flourished since Deng came to power during the Deng years, and for that matter, in the post-Deng years. The means of the capitalist market very soon overwhelmed the socialist ends they were originally intended to serve, and what resulted is probably the most rapid and certainly the most massive process of capitalist development in world history over the past two decades. To be sure, what has been constructed is hardly a model of pure capitalism. It's something that I would call bureaucratic capitalism, as I indicated before, a capitalist system whose creation and functioning is very much tied up with the political power of the Chinese Communist Party. But it is capitalism nonetheless, and I think a very, and quite obviously a very dynamic version of it. The phenomenon of bureaucratic capitalism brings me back finally to Professor Cumming's question with which I began. Professor Cumming's, as you recall, asked whether the communist regime really achieved anything positive that the Kuomintang would not have achieved had it remained in power after 1949. And the reappearance of this phenomenon of bureaucratic capitalism places that question into particularly sharp relief. Because the Kuomintang presided over in its relatively brief tenure over a bureaucratic capitalist system prior to 1949, which the communists as well as others quite rightly denounced as corrupt and parasitic. Now today, 50 years later, one finds the Chinese Communist Party presiding over a system of bureaucratic capitalism that seems in some respects very similar. And one might well ask, as Professor Cummings implies, what really has changed? It seems to me a great deal has changed. And even the two bureaucratic capitalist systems, as ugly as both of them are different. In the first case, in the case of the Kuomintang, high Kuomintang officials preyed on a stagnant economy and, in effect, reinforced backwardness. Whereas communist bureaucratic capitalism, however corrupt, is associated with an extraordinarily dynamic economy. But what is more important, I think, is to consider the communist period over the historical long term, the decades, the 50 years since 1949, and the transformation of China over that period from one of the most wretched and impoverished lands in the world, known in the early 20th century as the land of famine, the sick man of Asia, and similar terms. The transformation of that wretched country into one of the world's largest and most rapidly growing industrial powers. The gross domestic product of China has quadrupled in the last 20 years alone. Possibly the same results would have come under the Kuomintang had it remained in power. But one doesn't really know, and it's not terribly fruitful to speculate too long, it seems to me. about what might have happened had other things not happened. As it is, both credit for the achievements and blame for the crimes of the past half century must rest with the Chinese communists. The argument that the Kuomintang would have modernized mainland China had it remained in power is usually derived from its extrapolated, as it were, from its relative success in modernizing Taiwan the post-World War II years. The two cases are, I think, hardly comparable, or for that matter, comparable. No serious practitioner of comparative methodology in any academic discipline would contemplate such a comparison if only on demographic grounds alone. One cannot usefully compare a country of over 1 billion people and all the socioeconomic problems that that itself generates and entails with an island inhabited by less than 20 million people. Not to speak of all of the other geographical, economic, and historical differences that would likely make such a comparison meaningless. But there are also concrete social and political reasons why the Kuomintang failed on the mainland, quite apart, and why it probably would have continued to fail after 1949. Take, for example, the very crucial issue of agrarian reform, land reform. In Taiwan, the Kuomintang carried out a very successful land reform campaign in the 1950s and 1960s. That was the essential prerequisite for its rapid industrialization in the 1970s and 1980s. However, when it ruled the mainland, the Kuomintang made no serious attempt to reform the countryside. And indeed, could probably not have done so even had its leaders had the insight and determination to do so. This was the case, I think, for many reasons, beyond vast differences in size, population, levels of economic development between the mainland and Taiwan. There are two other critical factors that should be mentioned. First, on the mainland, the nationalist regime never really controlled the vast countryside. Its bureaucracy was bloated, overbearing, but it was very superficial in many respects. Especially as far as the countryside was concerned, and left the villages pretty much where they were, that is, in the hands of local landlord elites. The Kuomintang was an urban-based regime, simply put, that removed itself from the countryside and all of its problems. Even had there been an urgent sense to undertake land reform among Kuomintang leaders, which was not the case, it simply did not have the administrative control of rural China to effectively do so. Secondly, there were social reasons that precluded land reform in Kuomintang China. Kuomintang leaders had no desire to alienate the officer corps of the Nationalist Army, most of whose members came from gentry landlord families. Nor did they wish to alienate Kuomintang-aligned urban moneyed elites who invested in the agrarian sector, in landlordism, in money lending, and the like. These political and social constraints, which prevented meaningful or any real attempt at land reform on the mainland when the Kuomintang ruled the mainland, no longer existed in Taiwan when the remnants of the Kuomintang fled to the island after its defeat in the civil war with the communists in mainland China. Politically, the 2 million mainlanders who arrived in China in various waves after the end of World War II till 1949, had no difficulty, they were mostly soldiers and bureaucrats, had no difficulty exercising firm control over a Taiwanese population of approximately 10 million, a population who had lived under a Japanese colonial regime for the 50 previous years, from 1895 to the end of World War II in 1945. Furthermore, there were no social class inhibitions on the part of the Kuomintang in Taiwan. The Kuomintang leaders viewed Taiwanese landlords in part as sort of Japanese collaborators, people who had gotten along and lived under the Japanese colonial regime, and had few qualms then in carrying out a successful land reform, which partly dispossessed those landlords, from which there followed successful industrialization. The point here that needs to be stressed is a very simple one, and that is one cannot take Kuomintang Taiwan and project it back into the time that the Kuomintang ruled the mainland. The two historical situations are just too different to be comparable. A more meaningful comparison would be between China and India, countries of similar size, population, roughly at the same levels of economic development in the late 1940s, and both among the poorest countries in the world at that time. Professor Sen has done extensive comparative work on China and India, and sets forth some of the following examples, which I'll very briefly relate. These figures are from the early 1990s. He finds that per capita gross national product, based on the measure of purchasing power parity, was twice as high in China as it was in India. Life expectancy was 69 years in China, 59 years in India. Infant mortality was 31 per thousand in China, 79 per thousand in India. Low birth weight babies constituted only 9% of births in China, 33% in India. China had a significantly higher rate of literacy and so forth. I don't know how one can explain these differences and many others that could be cited without taking into account the fact that China experienced a social revolution in 1949. And India did not. It experienced a political revolution, but along with that, a persistence of parasitic landlordism. How then, in conclusion, should one reply to Professor Cumming's query about whether the Chinese communists accomplished anything positive that also would not have been achieved without them? My response to that question, my attempt to answer that question, is that revolution and the revolution of 1949 in particular probably was necessary, at least in Chinese historical circumstances, to achieve the social and political preconditions. Particularly land reform was important, but other things as well. The preconditions that were essential for the very considerable economic and industrial progress that has been made. The impact of that economic progress, I think, is reflected in the striking differences between China and India in terms of quality of human life, reflected in the comparisons that Professor Sen brings to our attention. To be sure, the human costs of the Chinese Revolution have been great. not only the many millions who perished in the long revolutionary struggle, but in the many more millions who were politically persecuted after the revolutionaries came to power. Not to speak of the 20 million or more who perished as a result of the political misadventure of the Great Leap Forward. How one weighs the heavy costs of revolution against its undeniable benefits is a terribly agonizing dilemma, which I think reasonable people can come to different conclusions about. But to put the matter in somewhat different terms, I don't think any serious student of China or any serious student of anywhere else can avoid the obligation to weigh not only the costs of revolution, but weigh the costs of going without revolution. This, in fact, is very rarely done. Barrington Moore was one of the few who did so. He did so three decades ago in his classic study, Social Origins of Dictatorship and Democracy, especially in his lengthy chapter in India, where he demonstrates with terrifying power the enormous human costs India has suffered because it did not experience a social revolution in the late 1940s, therefore had little in the way of land reform and consequently a weak basis for industrialization. Moore's chapter in India, which I commend to you, enables me to understand why an Indian friend and colleague refers to India as a country where almost half the population, 400 million people, are, as he puts it, slowly starving to death. That is to say, 400 million people are chronically malnourished and will die prematurely. Let me make one final comment. Revolutions quite obviously assume different social shapes and meanings at different points in time after they occur. And one can only look at the Chinese Revolution from the perspective of the present. All history, someone said, is the history of the present. And from that perspective, the Chinese Communist Revolution would have to be called a capitalist or bourgeois revolution, one that opened the way not for a socialist society, but rather for the development of capitalism. I would have preferred a socialist outcome, but socialism, to paraphrase Sir Thomas More, was something I hoped more than expected to see. But I suppose I remain in many ways sufficiently influenced by original Marxism to believe that capitalism is probably a necessary and possibly progressive phase in historical development despite its social ravages. And insofar as that process of capitalist economic development that has been taking place in China in recent decades and is taking place now, insofar as it has bettered the material and intellectual lives of hundreds of millions of people, enables them to enjoy a better standard of living, this process of economic development has an enormous moral significance. And it also fulfills one of the key demands of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, set forth in 1948, 1 year before the victory of the Chinese Revolution, a declaration which recognizes among human rights a decent standard of living, access to health care, and a public education. In that sense, in the sense that it has saved, prolonged, and bettered the lives of more people than any other single political event in world history, the Chinese Revolution of 1949 must be seen as one of the great achievements of the 20th century. Thank you.
Why don't you stay there? Professor Meissner is willing to answer questions, and I think after that lecture there will be one or two. And when you ask a question, it would be helpful if you will identify yourself first. Who would like to ask a question? Yes, please. There's a microphone behind you so we can all hear.
Right, my name's Han Ho. I'm a third year undergrad here. You talk about the development of the Chinese economy in very glowing terms, and you rightly refer to the human costs involved in the revolution during the Maoist era without stating your actual conclusion. Can I infer from what you said in your concluding remarks that you feel that the abuse of human civil rights was a necessary and worthwhile condition of rapid economic development?
No, I don't think it was necessary. It certainly was not worthwhile. And it should be deplored and protested, which I have done on many occasions. But it should not be used to obscure the genuine progress that has been made. For example, I think it would be foolish to make such a calculation, but if one were going to calculate the number of lives that have been saved, improved, given birth to, the number of when life expectancy is more than doubled in a period of in a very short period, an awful number of human lives are bettered and made possible, human lives that otherwise would not have existed. If one uses figures of that sort, and I would not attempt to do so, and uses the same measures, the same kinds of calculations that are used to measure the famine deaths from the Great Leap Forward, which I regard as the greatest horror of the Chinese Revolution, one would come to a saving of human lives that would far outweigh the number of famine deaths. I think it would be silly to make such a comparison, and I wouldn't do so. The famine deaths and all the other abuses, political and otherwise, have to be condemned and must be condemned, and I don't think that they were necessary in any sense. For the progress that was being made. But these should not be used to obscure the genuine progress that's been made and the human meaning of that progress. I'm trying to strike a balance, particularly in view of the enormous anti-China sentiment that exists in the world at present.
At the back, please. No, over there.
Oh, yes, my name's Paul Clifton. I'm an outside visitor. I'd be interested in your views as to how China's likely to develop from here. How long can this bureaucratic capitalism be sustained? And can China remain such a massive unified state?
Economically, what happens from here, of course, is unpredictable. The present economic situation is a very dire one, I think, in many ways. But it's dire in many countries. China, having gained the benefits of integration into what we call the world capitalist market, is now suffering some of the consequences of the movements of that market. As I think any country part of that market would. What the outcome of that will be, I don't know. If you know what the economic outlook is for the global economy, perhaps you can tell me. I suspect China's future in that respect is very much tied up with the global economic outlook. In terms of unity, I think the force of nationalism in China is still extraordinarily powerful. Countries that have been in far worse shape economically than conceivably China could ever be, even under adverse global economic conditions, have managed to stay unified. India, for example, the force of nationalism in China, if nothing else, would keep China unified. I don't think there is any likelihood or prospect of China breaking up into various parts.
Yes, please, down the front.
Sorry. My name is Charles Regan, and I was a student in this place about half a century ago. You placed a good deal of emphasis on statistics of various kinds, mm-hmm. comparing China in the early 90s with India in the early 90s, and I think the lesson you drew that the one did much better than the other because of the revolution in the one and the lack of revolution in the other. But isn't the valid comparison that ought to be made between India in 1949 and India in 1999, rather than India and China in 1999. In other words, what I am arguing is that you cannot make the point, yes. As you did, I think, that India fell so far behind simply by comparing it with China at the present time.
No, I would agree with you, and I think the most valid comparison for China is not with India, but with China 50 years ago, as would be the case with India. Comparison with India is made by Professor Sen, among others, because they believe certain matters of public policy are very important in economic development and in the quality of human life. Professor Sen's one of his arguments, as I understand it, is that many of the social reforms that were undertaken in China, during a period of not terribly rapid growth, were essential for both the quality of life in China and made possible the very dynamic growth that occurred in the post-Mao period, at least until recently. In that sense, I think comparisons between China and India are useful. But I would agree with you basically that the real comparison is India in 1947 and India today, China in 1949 and China today.
Joanne Davis, first year PhD student at the LSE. I was just wondering, because you look at the French and Chinese revolutions, and the French, obviously, the principles that are supposed to stick are fraternity, liberty, and equality. Chinese, given that it's supposed to be a communist revolution, and yet you agree is neither democratic nor socialist, and given your sympathies with Marx, would you not say that in that way, as a communist revolution, and in terms of what both the supposed communist revolutions in Russia and China have done to the term, its use, and the fact that we supposedly now live in a post-communist world, that in that sense it has failed, and perhaps has negatively so in a future sense as well, in terms of ever being able to use that term in a positive socialist, liberal, democratic way again?
I would agree with you that I'm communist with a capital C, certainly. I don't know that it does anything to
the ideal of communism, or for that matter, the ideal of socialism. The notion of socialism, or the concept of socialism, has, I think, been not only distorted by communists, but also misunderstood by anti-communists, in the sense that socialism has come to be identified, and this is in part the result of certain socialists and certain Marxists, even before Stalin, identifying socialism with state control, with the state. And therefore, the term socialism, as it's used in the common political discourse, is the more state control is, the more state control there is, the more socialist something is. Stalin was happy with that definition. I don't think Marx would have been. And I certainly agree with you that the concept, the ideal of socialism, has to be rescued from its perversion in the 20th century, both ideological and political perversion. If I use the word communist as an ideal, I use it with a small c and not a large one.
Okay, so there, I'll take two more questions, and there are two hands, the gentleman over there, and then one over there.
Philip Harris, member of the public. At the risk of taking you to a very different area, touched on by the previous questioner, have you attempted, or would you be care to attempt, a similar comparison, not between economic development in China and India, but between economic development in China and the former Soviet Union, or the Community of Independent States, or whatever you like to call it?
I would not be able really to do so. If one undertook a comparison today, obviously China would look very good, and the Soviet Union, where production has, I think, been halved since the fall of communism, would look quite terrible. But if you looked at the Soviet Union during its supposedly growth period, it grew, of course, quite rapidly. I think the figures that I have seen is that the growth measured in terms of decades, taking the most rapid periods of industrialization during the Mao period and during the Stalin period in China, still favor China by a degree. But Russia, of course, started from a much higher material base in 1917. Than China did in 1949. I think I once calculated that that in terms of industrial production, China had, on a per capita basis, about 1/8 of the industrial production that Tsarist Russia had at the time of the 1917 revolution. So China started from a much lower base. It had there were many more problems. There was no agricultural surplus as there was in, or none to speak of as there was in. Conditions in China were much more difficult. The pace of development was approximately the same. It also had many of the same problems. And I think the reforms, not necessarily the ones that were undertaken specifically, but the reforms that were decided upon by the Chinese Communist Party in the late 1970s, reforms of some sort were quite obviously necessary if China was going to avoid the fate that we have seen in the Soviet Union.
Hi, Phil Deans. I lecture in Chinese politics at the School of Oriental and African Studies. I found myself in very broad agreement with much of your talk, so I'd like to ask you about a comment you made at the start and in response to one of the questions about rising anti-Chinese sentiment. I agree very much that this is occurring, but I'd like to ask you what you think the root cause of this is in the American context and how you see this anti-Chinese feeling developing.
In the American context, I really can't say, because I find the United States a rather inscrutable country and I don't understand its politics, and you undoubtedly have read quite a bit about American politics over the past year, so that you know the difficulties of understanding the politics and history of that land, that strange, faraway land in many ways. The usual explanation that is given by sober commentators, of which there are relatively few, is the natural reaction of an established power to a rising power that might someday in some unforeseeable future rival it or threaten it in some fashion or another. That seems to me so far away, so far in the distant future as a remote possibility, that I find it very difficult to take seriously, but who knows what goes on in the minds of people. Certainly a latent racism is there, anti-Chinese racism, as Harold Isaacs pointed out in his marvelous book, Scratches in Our Minds, I think was the original title. Stereotypes of Chinese and Indians, for example, both negative and positive, rise and fall with the political tides. And these stereotypes are there. I think that I find it rather odd, I'm not quite sure how one explains it, that most of those who, those Chinese Americans who have been singled out as responsible, presumably for illegal fundraising given to Clinton and the Democratic Party or before, those who presumably are responsible for security breaches, spying, and so forth, are virtually all Taiwanese. Perhaps you can explain that.
They've got the money, I think.
Thank you very much. I appreciate your attention.
Well, for someone who claims he doesn't understand the United States, he certainly understands the culture of the LSE. As I think many of you know, that the motto of the LSE, translated into English, is to know the causes of things. And what you've done this evening is very much in the LSE tradition, to ask the big question and to address it in a scholarly way, in a detached way, and as you've said yourself, in a balanced way. And you've drawn on your own considerable erudition and great experience. And for that, we're very much in your debt. Thank you.
Thank you.